Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the early 1900s, women were in a bitter stalemate with the government. After years of campaigning peacefully to gain the right to vote, they'd had enough. The inequality they faced, the expected homemaker lifestyle they were meant to adopt, and the reduced pay they were gaslit into accepting, led them to turn to the only remaining option left. Revolution. There were two main leaders in the fight for women's suffrage, the peaceful National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies and the disruptive Women's Social and Political Union. The latter of the two had decided after years of playing nice, the time had come to hit the men in power in the place they cared about the most, their pockets. They began a campaign of major destruction, which has been retrospectively regarded as the largest ever organised terrorist group in the whole of England. And their actions, whilst controversial in nature, ultimately played a huge part in winning the vote for women. After the event of Black Friday, the riot which saw suffragettes from both major groups be beaten, assaulted and arrested by police who carried out a systematic misogynistic attack on a group of 300 kettled women in a space they couldn't escape, the message was heard loud and clear from the authorities. They had resorted to violence, and in retaliation, the WSPU decided it would speak in the same language and destroy everything in their path until they got what they wanted. Today on Macabre London, in our final part of this four-part series, we uncover the fight to win the vote and the violent deeds carried out by the suffragettes to get it. And welcome back to another episode of Macabre London. I'm Nikki Drews, your host with a silent G, and today I'll be taking you on a journey down another of London's grimy backstreets to uncover a macabre tale from the city's past. And this time, we're picking back up with part four in this mini-series and inciting this meeting to rebellion to finish up this exploration into the suffragette movement. But first, if you're new here and you want to see more videos where we deep dive into historic tales from London's past and sometimes all over the world, then please don't forget to subscribe or follow so you never miss a new episode. If you like what I make and you have done for a while now, I have a Patreon where you can get more of the show. There is my extra podcast, which is exclusive to Patreon, called Having a Problem, which is lots of silly fun with a bit of history thrown in, and a new episode has just gone up over there, all about the problem with love. We look into the origins of Cupid, ask each other some deep questions about relationships past and present, and try to get to the root cause of exactly what makes romance so weird and wonderful. It's a really fun episode, which I'm sure you'll enjoy, and there's a whole back catalogue of them now too. So if you sign up for less than a cup of coffee, you can have a good old binge. Patreon really is the best way to support what I make, to make sure the show can continue, so why not take a look on patreon.com/macabre London. On the last episode of our suffragette series, we learned about the bitter battle of Black Friday, an event in which 300 suffragettes had been kettled by police into Parliament Square and subjected to 6 hours of continuous beatings, attacks and violence from the men who were meant to be the guardians of the streets. And yet, here they were being the perpetrators of many heinous crimes and aiding and abetting members of the public to do the same. The after effects of Black Friday had a huge knock-on effect for women who were there that day. A number of political protesters decided they no longer wanted to fight for the cause and stepped down from their positions. Others didn't want to face the humiliation and danger of imprisonment, and many others were persuaded by the men in their families to lay low until the tensions had calmed down. However, on the other hand, this event had sparked a turning point within one group in particular, the WSPU, and they decided from that day onward they would fight fire with fire. If they were going to be treated with violence, they would do the same. Women had duly marched and protested peacefully for 50 years to try and win the vote, but after the repeated knockbacks they'd faced from the government, and in particular the current Prime Minister, Henry Asquith, they knew they'd have to dial it up until their actions started making a difference. Now, before I delve into the militancy of the WSPU, this era was not fantastically well documented. Some of it has been sanitised to remove the struggle to win the vote in favour of making both sides look like it was just a simple misunderstanding. But in fact, the truth, when you begin scratching the surface, is far more gritty than we've been led to believe. Whilst the women's suffrage movements were noble and stoic in their approach to win the fight, they were also incredibly violent, bullheaded and reckless. The image of a suffragette being pinned down and force-fed in prison has no doubt become one of the most harrowing images in political history, but equally the images of damage the suffragettes caused against property, people and public infrastructure have largely been hidden from view. This attempt to deliberately hide this violent behaviour was more than likely a tactic used by the government to hide the fact that it was under threat of losing control to a relatively small organisation who would stop at nothing to get what they wanted. And worst of all, they were women. The people who were meant to be under the thumb of the patriarchal society and should do exactly what was expected of them at all times. All of this is to say that what is available today in terms of historical records from the time is patchy, disjointed, and some parts of it have been erased. Which parts, however, we'll never know. The control over the press at the time and the silencing of the left meant that a true, accurate representation is difficult to ascertain. However, the production of the suffragette's own newspaper does give us some insight, but because a source which is creating its own news output can be sensationalist, we'll have to try and find a happy middle ground between the two warring factions, neither of which wanted to speak favourably about the other. By this time in the fight for women's suffrage and universal suffrage as a whole, there had been many bills presented to the government, and all of them had been thrown out, filibustered, or rejected by those in power. The continual and rising taxation of these disenfranchised groups meant they were becoming desperate. They were expected to fund the government, pay their wages, and work in a society which didn't work for them. This lack of input into the day-to-day running of the country meant that those in power were able to control what women did entirely. They could disrupt their careers, take away their freedom and money at the drop of a hat, and put divorced, homeless women in workhouses. This complete control was only getting worse, and so the tactics these women were using to protest these changes had to tread the same path. The WSPU had, up until this point, stuck to loud protest. They infiltrated government meetings and heckled the politicians who opposed their plight. They purposefully shoved policemen and spat at them so they would be arrested, which would get them column inches in the press. However, the campaign had focused on mischief rather than all-out violence. But in 1909, when a revolutionary act of defiance happened within the group towards the government, it changed the course of protest for the group. In July 1909, a member of the WSPU was arrested for militancy. Her name was Marion Wallace Dunlop, a Scottish-born artist. Marion decided of her own volition to begin a hunger strike until her demands were met. Initially, when suffragettes were arrested and imprisoned for their quote-unquote crimes, they were placed alongside the other run-of-the-mill prisoners in squalid conditions and subject to horrendous abuse. The request of the WSPU was that anyone arrested for political reasons should be housed as political prisoners. When Marion was placed in prison, she decided to protest this poor treatment by going on hunger strike. She didn't eat for 5 days, and when she seemingly had no intention of starting again until she was treated with the respect she deserved, the prison had to release her on the grounds of ill health. This deliberate manipulation of the system by Marion was highly commended by the WSPU, particularly Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst, who had a custom-made honour badge produced for her release. Marion's tactics were incredibly brave, but also incredibly clever. The act of refusing to eat meant the government had no other option but to release a suffragette from prison, as if they were to let her starve and martyr herself, the government would have her blood on their hands. This commendable stoic action was adopted by the suffragettes as a way to escape prison, and it was so effective that by September of the same year, just a few months after Marion was initially arrested, they had enacted a law by which they could force feed inmates if they went on hunger strike. This gruesome and violent act of torture was brought in as a deliberate deterrent to those planning to defy the government, and many women were put through this brutal procedure. The act of force feeding saw a tube passed through the nose and into the stomach, and often required several people to hold down the victim. The procedure was painful and often resulted in other injuries too. Teeth could be broken, the mouth could be bruised or cut, bruising happened during restraint, and the tube could also be accidentally passed down the windpipe, risking food going into the lungs. Often, as these women hadn't eaten for some time, they would then immediately be sick again afterwards, as the stomach wasn't expecting food and nor could it cope with it. To make matters even worse, the actual act of force feeding didn't even provide enough essential nutrients to warrant doing it, and the prisoners were still often dismissed from prison on grounds of ill health. But the whole ordeal was persisted with, as it was a very visceral display of the torture that would be endured if women protested. Hunger strikes went on amongst suffragettes for 5 years, and the WSPU used them as a badge of honour, quite literally. The commemorative pin that Marion obtained initially after her brave creation of the technique was replicated and given out to those who underwent a period of hunger strike within prison. These badges of honour would be displayed proudly, and over the 5 years, a whopping 82 medals were awarded. This confirmed number is joined by a suspected further 64 medals, the whereabouts of which have not been able to be tracked down. The 82 medals, which are dotted across the globe in museums and private collections, are regarded as some of the most important historical political artefacts in the world. And when they find their way onto the market, they regularly reach prices of over £20,000. So if you had a great-grandma who was a suffragette, you might want to go rooting around in those boxes of antiques in the loft. A common souvenir from Holloway Prison, which accompanied the proud medals, was a small loaf of brown bread, the likes of which was intentionally left to become rock solid and then held aloft when leaving prison as a sign they'd won the battle. And it wasn't just women who underwent hunger strikes, men too played their part. Hugh Franklin, a member of the Men's Political Union for Women's Enfranchisement, underwent 2 periods of hunger strike as an ally to the suffragettes' cause. Emmeline Pankhurst herself played a tormented game with the government, where she would be arrested, go on hunger strike, become unwell, be released, and then be imprisoned once well enough to be reincarcerated. While she herself avoided the brutality of being force-fed, as the government couldn't do that to such a high-profile leader who was in her 50s, and I also doubt they would have dared to, she stood in solidarity with her sisters that did, and she was vehemently opposed to this dehumanisation of her fellow protesters, giving many speeches and making sure the stories hit the papers so everyone knew exactly what the government were up to in the confines of their protected prisons. The Cat and Mouse Act was developed by the government to prevent deaths while suffragettes were serving at His Majesty's pleasure, and the whole affair gained sympathy with the public, as it was one thing to arrest someone and imprison them, but another to make them return time and time again, seemingly on an indefinite sentence under which they could be legally tortured. In order to make sure prisoners served their full sentence, the striking women would be released until they recovered, and then they would be re-arrested all over again, sometimes with additional length added to their initial sentence. This change to the law was of course not honoured by the suffragettes, and so on release, many women would go to safe houses to recuperate and then carry out more militant acts whilst hiding from the police. Some, like well-known WSPU arsonist Kitty Marion, took their cat and mouse licence to the scene of their crimes and left it behind with all the identifying details cut out, just so they could taunt the police. But what exactly ended up putting these women behind bars? Well, over the years, the list of offences was only becoming more extreme. Initially, protests such as chaining themselves to railings at high-profile sites such as the royal residence of Buckingham Palace was about as unruly as it got, but the longer the time went on, the more inventive the WSPU got. Members would consult the local papers to find out where politicians who opposed women's suffrage would be speaking, and they would sneak in, hide in buildings, and then, just as they were reaching the main point of their speech, emerge and shout them down and wave banners. In Liverpool, Mary Phillips hid inside a local church, climbing into the organ loft, where she stayed overnight. The following day, she moved underneath the stage and emerged during a speech, protesting the imprisonment of Patricia Woodlock, a fellow Liverpudlian WSPU member. In 1909, women in Newcastle-upon-Tyne tried to protest a series of meetings of MPs, and when they were turned away from the places they were being held and barricaded out of the area, they threw stones at a nearby post office, smashing the windows, and then attacked the barrier with a hatchet before they were duly arrested. Prisons across the country, which were holding suffragettes, were protested at, pelted with stones, and sit-ins were held by women outside in solidarity with their sisters behind bars. Then began the campaign of window smashing in 1911, which left no liberal-supporting business left untouched. The actions of the WSPU by this time were running like a well-oiled machine. The whole country was connected via a network of different societies, and the dedicated women that attended them knew how to plot and plan, turning the whole affair into a tight military operation. Across the land, the 5,000 members of the WSPU were plotting and scheming, and Emmeline came up with a plan that would begin their reign of terror. Now, of course, when carrying out such mental gymnastics, I'm sure these incredible brains would have benefited from a natural boost with the help of today's sponsor, London Nootropics, and their delicious adaptogenic coffee, which has been reliably responsible for giving me a brain boost for the past few years now. And I'm so pleased to be sharing this with you once again. Now, it's no secret that I absolutely adore London Nootropics adaptogenic coffee. In fact, to start this sponsorship, I reached out to them in the hopes that they'd say yes, and I was delighted when they did because their product is fantastic. So what is adaptogenic coffee? Well, their specially formulated blends combine many incredible ingredients which get you firing on all cylinders, but without the jitters and lack of focus regular coffee does. Their three blends, Flow, Mojo and Zen, all act in the way the name suggests. If you're looking to tap into your hyperfocus, then Flow is for you. If you want some get up and go, then Mojo is your gal. And then Zen is a calm yet tapped in blend. Medicinal mushroom extracts are adaptogens. They help your body and mind adapt to physical, mental, and emotional stressors. Blending them together with a fine microground coffee creates an earthy, delicious cup of coffee with additional health benefits. The microground coffee in their blends contains 6% freshly ground coffee, and the rest is spray-dried instant coffee powder and is tested for heavy metals, toxins, and mold. They taste delicious, and I always find that I burn through my subscription way before the next one arrives because they are that good. Now, the team at London Nootropics have just reformulated their Zen blend to pack it full of even more good stuff for your brain. Their Zen 2.0 blend will continue to incorporate the highest quality KSM 66 ashwagandha extract, which is known to work on our adrenals and can help to balance our cortisol, our stress hormone. In turn, this allows you to enjoy the benefits of coffee in your day whilst remaining balanced. The refined blend works better than before, with L-theanine having been added, and that's because these guys work with scientists to make sure their product is the best it can be. After 6 months of comprehensive testing, London Nootropics found the synergies between L-theanine, ashwagandha, and caffeine work incredibly well together to significantly improve daily balance and calming energy. Research shows L-theanine can balance out the heart rate spike from caffeine, leading to a calmer and more alert state of mind. It has also been established that L-theanine with caffeine can help counteract caffeine's impact on our deep sleep, ensuring we're well rested whilst remaining energized throughout our day. Another study concluded that individuals taking L-theanine saw notable decreases in anxiety and stress. So if that's not enough reasons alone to try it, then I have one more for you. I have a lovely discount code for you. Just head to londonnootropics.com and use the code MACABRE at checkout to get 20% off your order. I personally have a subscription because that also gets you money off, and I find that the longer I've been drinking their adaptogenic coffee, the better the results. But equally, if you just want to give it a go, they do one-off boxes too. I have a Mixbox subscription, which is £24 a month, and it's worth every penny. So if you're looking to elevate your day and start on your shroom journey, then head to londonnootropics.com and don't forget to tell them I sent you by using the discount code, this is all capital letters, MACABRE at checkout for your exclusive 20% off. And if you do, let me know. I know you're going to love it. Thanks so much to London Nootropics for sponsoring today's episode. Now, let's get back into it.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
By 1913, the WSPU labelled themselves proudly as a terrorist organisation. And in the run-up to this, they had carried out a series of escalating attacks which showed their mettle and increased the awareness of women's suffrage. In 1912, Emmeline sent out a coded message to her loyal followers, which would see them join together in London to carry out a synchronised attack, which would cause a lot of damage. The focus from the WSPU was to attack property, upset infrastructure, and cause as much disruption as possible. The aim was never to cause threat to life. However, this promise was often overlooked, and even though many people claim no lives were lost as a result of the suffragettes' attacks, there were at least four deaths attributed to their actions and a number of injuries sustained by innocent bystanders. The rhetoric of only damaging property was convenient, as the actions of the suffragettes were highly criticised by the upper echelons of society as mindless violence in which there was no regard for human life. So by carrying out actions which would only cause damage to property, it was displaying the suffragettes' disregard for the establishment, but not for human life. However, as soon as the campaign started to escalate to a point where people were becoming injured, the non-militant faction of the women's suffrage movement quickly turned against Emmeline and the WSPU. Millicent Fawcett started branding the NUWSS as the law-abiding suffragettes, to distinguish them from the WSPU's tactics. The 50,000 members of the NUWSS didn't want to be associated with the hooligans of the WSPU, as they believed their tactics were harming the cause and setting back the progress they'd made with their stoic approach. This caused Emmeline and Millicent to fall out with each other, but both respectfully stayed well clear of each other and didn't war publicly, as they both agreed this would hinder their message. The aim of only destroying material and inanimate objects by the WSPU was a good idea in theory, but in practice, such acts of violence were always going to inevitably have some kind of knock-on effect, or had the possibility of going wrong, which some did. The attack in 1912 didn't see anyone injured, but it did send a unified message to the press, which put the WSPU front and centre in a new era of terror. The attack was coordinated by Emmeline in a coded letter, which invited members of the WSPU to join together in a protest at Parliament Square. Once assembled, the women were issued with toffee hammers and told to smash as many windows as possible in the West End at 8 p.m. Many women got the memo and came armed with their specialist equipment. Some had specific hammers for the occasion and engraved them or wrote on the handles. One particular hammer recovered from the scene had the words, "Better broken windows than broken promises," emblazoned upon the wood. This wanton display of destruction resulted in many arrests, and some women didn't even make it to their intended targets. By this time, the police had infiltrated the suffragette network and were using secret police and spies to intercept messages, which meant they were prepared for the attack before it happened. On the day, the women gathered, and many did manage to smash windows at the 8 p.m. call time, and as Edwardian women, they were able to hide their weapons discreetly inside their clothing, which consisted of many layers and accessories. Hats, shawls, and even fur muffs were used to disguise batons, clubs, hammers, and stones from any suspecting police officer, and the groups had purposefully split into smaller size and went off to get a bite to eat before the 8 p.m. kickoff. When the clock towers began ringing out their eight bells, the women went into a smashing frenzy, with over 100 targets destroyed. The police were in waiting for the acts to be carried out, so they could arrest as many women as possible, and 126 suffragettes were captured and convicted of their crimes. The punishments handed out ranged in severity from 14 days through to 6 months hard labour. Judges were inherently classist, and the lower class women received the harshest of sentences, whereas those considered middle to upper received minimal time behind bars and no hard labour. For many women, their involvement in the 1912 attack was their first offence, and they weren't treated kindly for it. The idea to hand out as harsh a sentence as was allowed by law for the crime was decided upon to dissuade many from returning to militancy once released, and for many women, it worked. If working families were dependent on two incomes into the household, having one breadwinner behind bars was enough to put their children and husbands out on the streets. Many men during this period decided not to side with their wives in the fight for suffrage, taking it as a personal dig against their family. But for those women, the need to fight for future freedoms was a necessity, and they opted to lose everything in order to gain everything. Over 1912, the escalation of the attacks excelled rapidly. They went from simple window smashing and riotous protests to arson. Over the summer of 1912, three houses of anti-suffrage politicians were burned to the ground. These attacks were coordinated on houses which the suffragettes believed to be empty, and if occupants were at home, they wouldn't strike. However, this was a thin line to tread, and the margin for error, which could result in loss of life, was shaky at best. This was amplified when the suffragettes began experimenting with making incendiary devices. These crudely made bombs were volatile, and as no one within the suffragettes was an expert at making them, this was incredibly dangerous stuff to be messing around with. In fact, two suffragettes themselves would be injured by bomb blasts as they miscalculated the amount of time it would take to go off and found themselves caught up in friendly fire. The summer of terror continued when in July in Dublin, a hatchet was hurled towards Prime Minister Henry Asquith. It narrowly missed him, but managed to slice the ear of Irish MP John Redmond. This distraction attack, which was carried out by Mary Lee, was a way to avoid other suffragettes being caught setting bombs in the nearby Theatre Royal. The suffragettes lay in wait for the evening's performance to be over before setting them off, but they went off a little too soon, just as the audience was leaving for the night. They subsequently finished the job by setting fire to the building. A further five attacks were claimed by the suffragettes in the remainder of 1912. A bomb was laid in the Home Secretary's office, Reginald McKenna, but it was found before it exploded. Hugh Franklin, who also underwent a hunger strike on behalf of women's suffrage, set fire to a train carriage he was on when it reached its last stop. Luckily, no one was hurt. Postboxes were rigged to explode, and others were set fire to by pouring paraffin inside and setting light to them by dropping in a match. Train signals were tied together to try and cause a head-on collision, but luckily that was noticed before anything happened. In 1913, this is when the campaign went into all-out war with the government, and the amount of attacks was believed to be the largest carried out by any British terrorist organisation in the country, before or since. Emmeline had cited in a speech that the members of the WSPU should resort to using guerrilla warfare to win the vote. In the winter of 1912, a franchise bill was raised in the House of Commons. If it made it through, it would have allowed a series of amendments which would have introduced women's suffrage. But by the 24th of January 1913, when it finally made it into discussion, the Speaker of the House forced the House to abandon the bill. This was the final straw for Emmeline, and the subsequent decision to give them hell was made. With 30 incidents taking place across the course of the year, the suffragettes were on the warpath, and it was becoming incredibly dangerous and very risky for both the group themselves and the public at large. In January 1913, they sent a barrage of letter bombs to Prime Minister Asquith, but none of the bombs made it to their intended targets, exploding in transit or being discovered and defused. These accidental explosions caused five postmen to sustain burn injuries as a result. In February, Emily Davison, one of the chief militants for the WSPU, went to the Chancellor of the Exchequer and future Prime Minister David Lloyd George's house and set two bombs. Only one went off, but it caused significant damage. The suffragettes chose this target on purpose as the home was in the final stages of completion, and Lloyd George was going to be moving in during Easter, which would have been just a few months away. This bombing would have caused maximum disruption to the Liberal MP, but as the house was empty, there was no risk to life and the attack was carried out outside of working hours. Other attacks weren't quite so carefully planned, and some of the members of the organisation went rogue and acted alone in their deeds. However, they were all united with one goal in mind, and so the violence they used, they felt was imperative to the cause. Amongst the previous two incidents were also reports of further letter bombs, one which injured a postman in Lewisham. An attempt to burn down Wimbledon Tennis Club, more interference with railway signals, which went on throughout the first quarter of 1913, and the smashing of a display at the Tower of London. In April, six incidents occurred, ranging from bombing train lines, attempting to bomb the Bank of England, two bombs on packed commuter trains, one which is discovered but the other goes off and sets fire to the carriage. Luckily, no one is hurt. And that's not all. Even children weren't safe, as the suffragettes also targeted schools. However, they only went for government-owned schools and Church of England targets. The suffragettes believed that the Church of England was contributing to the hindrance of women's suffrage, as they reinforced the beliefs that women should be well-behaved, submissive, and good little housewives who stayed at home and looked after everyone. Both the government and the church had real concerns that if women were liberated and allowed to do as they wished, they would lose control of society and everything would fall apart. Another MP, Arthur Ducross's home, is burned down in April. No one is injured, but then police stumble across a more involved plot, which would see Crystal Palace football ground bombed. However, the night before the 1913 FA Cup final, those involved were arrested. By May, the letter bomb campaign had ended due to criticism because of its tendency to, well, injure innocent bystanders. So instead, the suffragettes placed dangerous chemicals in envelopes and send them to their targets. But this once again goes wrong, and more postmen are unintentionally hurt. In May alone, seven bombs are found dotted across London, and one in Reading, which is thrown from an express train onto a platform, which detonates it, but no one was injured. Despite Emmeline's assurances that the bombing was never intended to hurt anyone, there is one assassination attempt on an anti-suffrage magistrate at Bow Street Court, and another bomb discovered at Liverpool Street Station waiting room, which has nuts and bolts inside it. This bomb was very much designed to cause maximum damage and a threat to life. Equally, more train bombs are discovered on packed commuter trains and one on the Tube, and another at St Paul's Cathedral, all places where the general public would be. Now, it pains me to say this because it sounds like a cliché misogynistic statement, but in all reality, the suffragettes weren't actually that great at making bombs. They lacked the skill, as they were having to do this with very basic knowledge, and in fact, it's probably a good thing they didn't really know what they were doing, or else a hell of a lot more innocent people would have been injured and possibly killed as a result. So, as the bombs were somewhat dispensed with after so many failed attempts in the first half of the year, they switched tactics back to good old-fashioned arson. In early June 1913, suffragettes started a series of fires in Bradford, which claimed the lives of two men and several horses. These are the first deaths attributed to the cause, which hadn't been from the suffragettes themselves. Then, an event occurs which becomes the biggest militant act carried out by a singular suffragette, one which would sadly result in her death. Emily Wilding Davison was a prominent suffragette within the WSPU and was highly militant, having been responsible for many attacks, and was imprisoned many times as well. On June the 8th, 1913, during the Epsom Derby, Davison ducked under the barrier and made her way onto the racecourse. It's not entirely known what her intention was, as she didn't discuss her plans with anyone before carrying it out. The king's horse was in the Derby, and it's believed she went to grab the bridle to be able to attach a WSPU flag to the tack, but underestimated how a horse travelling at full speed would be as easy to stop running as jumping in front of a truck. Poor Emily was hit head-on by the horse and the jockey, with all three going flying. The jockey sustained minor injuries and made a full recovery, as did the horse, but poor Emily wouldn't be so lucky. She was taken to hospital, where she was operated on after 48 hours, but her injuries were too severe, and she'd suffered a fractured skull, which she died from a few days later. This act of selfless martyrdom for the suffrage cause made a shift in sympathy for some people. Her heroic bravery was seen as a sacrifice by some which had, up until this point, not wanted to take the cause seriously. But now someone had so publicly died for it, it did begin to start winning people's support. In later years, historians theorised that Emily had no intention of dying that day, as firstly, she left no note, she didn't leave her affairs in order, and she even bought a return ticket for the train home. The accident was seemingly just that, but her bravery to attempt to protest in this way inadvertently sent a message to the wider world. Gaining the right to vote for women was something they were willing to die for. Now, if you thought nowadays that people can act unsympathetically, it was no different back then. Emily was sent hate mail while she was in hospital, and Queen Mary herself publicly referred to this person that she didn't know at all as a horrible woman. Emily became an accidental martyr and subsequent icon for suffrage-supporting women everywhere, often being portrayed with angel's wings. Her funeral was an enormous affair, with over 5,000 women leading the procession in London, bedecked in white, carrying wreaths, and wearing their white, purple and green sashes, the suffragette colours. In a bid to try and play down the event, the police decided to arrest Emmeline Pankhurst, who was getting ready to attend that morning, as a result of her being well enough to return to prison to fulfil her cat and mouse licence. This meant that the leader of the suffragettes didn't get to attend the funeral of its first fallen soldier, and Emmeline didn't get to say farewell to her friend. Throughout the rest of the summer of 1913, many more bombs were left which were intended to kill hundreds of people at a time, but they didn't detonate, including one which was intended to blow up a whole post office in London. Now, some bombs were planted so as to cause maximum disruption, but not necessarily damage to life. A series of bombs left at a canal in Birmingham was intended to burst its banks, which would have affected trade for miles around, and also caused major flooding. The bomb went off, but it didn't have the impact its creator expected, in which they hoped to flood the 11-mile stretch of town adjacent to the canal. Throughout the rest of the year, more schools, postboxes and Holloway Prison itself received the sucker punch of violence from the WSPU, and in December of 1913, two more people would die at the hands of the suffragettes when they started a fire at Portsmouth Dockyard. This rapid fire injured many and took the lives of two sailors who were trying to escape the blaze. Just a few days later, postal workers were injured when more letter bombs were discovered in Nottingham, where they exploded, causing serious burns to many workers. The further escalation in attacks, which were intended to or did cause deaths, could have been in retaliation to a comment made by the Home Secretary, whose house had gone up in flames at the beginning of the year. David Lloyd George said in the speech in Swindon in October of 1913 that he was, and I quote, "very glad to see militancy withering." This offhand comment was perhaps a deliberate attempt to publicly say the attacks were having no impact on the government's decisions to enforce suffrage, but when people were dying as a result, it was hard to ignore them, and the papers certainly weren't. Other foiled plots in 1913 included kidnapping of MPs and subjecting them to ongoing force feeding, as the suffragettes had endured themselves. But when Emmeline learned of this, it seemed a little too on the nose, and so the plan was called off. By 1914, the campaign was starting to calm down a little, perhaps as a result of the deaths and injuries sustained throughout the seven-month campaign, and perhaps as a result of tensions beginning to build outside of the suffrage movement overseas, which had everyone scared as to what would happen next. Only 9 attacks were carried out between January to July. In January 1914, dynamite was thrown at policemen in training, with one officer injured. In February, Aberuchil Castle in Perthshire in Scotland was targeted and set on fire at night. Luckily, the servants inside noticed the fire and managed to all escape with their lives. In April, St Martin in the Fields is bombed and a fire starts inside. The debris from the shattered glass windows spills out onto the street, and several passers-by receive minor injuries as a result. The same month, the pier in Great Yarmouth is set alight, and the building on top of it is completely destroyed by the blaze. In May, another attempt at flooding is carried out when suffragettes place bombs next to Penistone Reservoir. If this had gone off as planned, quite literally, it would have probably caused the biggest loss to civilian life ever seen in the UK in a non-war-related event. Later in May, and also June and July, the interest was once again switched to churches, and three major targets were attempted to be hit. The Metropolitan Tabernacle in Elephant and Castle was rigged, but was discovered before it detonated. Westminster Abbey has a hit which damages the coronation chair, and St Paul's is once more targeted, but the device fails to detonate. The last attack was carried out by the WSPU in July 1914. A letter bomb exploded whilst on board a train and set fire to the carriage. Its discovery burns a worker who throws the device off the train, burning him in the process. Now, this is by no means an exhaustive list of every single incident that occurred. Some women began carrying whips with them and attacking any men they encountered which they knew or they believed to be opposed to women's suffrage. The self-titled reign of terror the suffragettes held over the course of 1912 and 1913 would go on to leave a horrifying legacy. Their approaches to endangering life would directly influence the Irish Republican Army, better known as the IRA. They copied many of the suffragettes' tactics and approaches in their attacks starting in 1919 and continuing decades later in the 1970s, 80s and 90s, but on a significantly larger scale. However, as time transpired and people's skills got much better in making these devices, the IRA's attempts would prove to be far more deadly than those of the suffragettes, but it was female violence which they copied. Now, this doesn't mean the opposing side were angels either. Many angry mobs descended on WSPU meetings and general combined suffrage events, which had thousands of attendees, and attacked women. At a rally in Hyde Park, where many thousands of women gathered, men pelted the protesters who were carrying out a calm parade with stones, sticks, and anything they could get their hands on. Police stormed meetings held at the Royal Albert Hall and tried to arrest women for being there. Some of those trying to arrest the women felt the unmerciless lick of a horsewhip as they did so. In prison, guards would routinely abuse the women, and they were restricted to being fed only bread and water. Both sides were fighting fire with fire, but one side was looking for a solution to a problem, whereas the other was just refusing to budge and grant any compromise at all, so it's no wonder they had to scream to make any difference. So why did the militant activities of the WSPU abruptly cease? Well, there was the small matter of a little something called World War I. As soon as war was declared in the UK, Emmeline Pankhurst issued a notice to henceforth cease all militant activities and instead, for the time being, focus on fighting the war. Many women were drafted into new positions, working the jobs the male soldiers had had to abandon as a result of their national service. Many suffragettes wanted to also fight for their country, but they were rejected by the government and pushed into the jobs that they needed to backfill. The war was incomprehensibly awful for everyone involved, and it completely disbanded the WSPU. The intensity of fighting one war meant there was no time or energy to fight another. Everyone was exhausted, and as Emmeline believed that the country needed to be fought for in order to keep it, she disbanded the WSPU in 1917. By the end of the war in 1918, women's roles in society had changed. They'd stepped into what was deemed as men's work and kept the country going. Those in charge knew that in a time when they could have abandoned everything, they didn't. Once again, the persistence of women paid off. They'd already been fighting one war, so when this one came along, they knew exactly what they were doing. It's a shame it took a world war for women to be thought of as just as capable as men. But as a result, when the war was over, things had changed and the time to bring the country together was upon the government. In 1918, the Representation of the People Act was finally passed. This granted all men over the age of 21 the right to vote. Unfortunately, this universal right wasn't granted to all women. Instead, it was regulated to women over 30 who owned property or had husbands that did. This wasn't the universal suffrage women were looking for, and it excluded a huge amount of the population yet again, but it was something. A token gesture to say thank you for their efforts during the war. Interestingly, the terms of giving women the right to stand as MPs was overlooked, and so technically, women who couldn't even vote could now put themselves forward for election, and they did. By October of that year, it was written in that women could now run for election, and the vote was passed by a whopping 274 votes in favour to 25 against, and immediately, candidates started popping up. The first woman to become an MP was Nancy Astor. She ran as MP for Plymouth and won as a Conservative Party member. It was 10 years later, in 1928, that voting was made available to all men and women over the age of 21 in the UK. And sadly, Emmeline wouldn't live that long to see universal suffrage awarded as she passed away on the 14th of June, 1928. The bill was passed on July the 2nd, just 19 days after she died. However, the actual agreement to the ruling happened in March of that year, so Emmeline would not have gone to her grave in ignorance. Perhaps once she knew the vote had been awarded, she could stop holding on. Millicent Fawcett, aged 82, went to Parliament the day the vote was granted, an invited guest of the Prime Minister. She wrote in her diary the same night, "It is almost exactly 61 years ago since I heard John Stuart Mill introduce his suffrage amendment to the Reform Bill on 20th of May 1867, so I have had extraordinary good luck in having seen the struggle from the beginning." Just a month and a few days later, Millicent would pass away. Perhaps she too had been holding on to complete her life's work, and now it was done, she could move on. Emmeline, in the last years of her life, gave speeches across America and Europe and became a highly regarded political speaker. Unfortunately, as many prominent figures did back then, she did start to go down the eugenics path, and so this somewhat tarnishes her final years, but it doesn't erase the world-changing work she did before that. Both Emmeline and Millicent would get statues made, which still stand proudly today. Emmeline, whose statue was erected in 1930, didn't make it to Parliament Square on account of her militant tactics, but she is in a position in the park across the street where she can still observe the area, and I don't believe she would have wanted to be in there anyway. It wasn't until 2018 when Millicent would finally get her statue, 100 years after some women were awarded the vote. She does have a place in Parliament Square, and despite being the leader of the larger faction of the women's suffrage movement, often gets forgotten in favour of Emmeline, who also has been immortalised in Madame Tussauds. The general election in 1929 was called the Flapper election, as 52% of the population could now vote, and boy did they ever. This record poll turnout has been something which has continued to happen every time there is a general election. More women, on average, vote than men. Many, myself included, turn up to vote regardless of what it's for, just because of these women and exercising the right they fought and died for us to have. Even from a young age, I was always told by my mum that I must vote because of the Pankhursts, and I hope that message is still being handed down to little girls now, as I know it had a profound effect on me, so much so that I always go to the polls. Eventually, the age to vote was brought down to 18 in 1969 and extended to the population as a whole. But even to this day, there are still questions about reform raging on. And if you want to learn more about this, make sure you check out the Electoral Reform Society. I'll leave a link to them and other helpful organisations in the description. Now, of course, since the universal vote was won 95 years ago, it hasn't been smooth sailing. there are still many injustices for women within politics. They remain underrepresented in leadership positions, holding only about a quarter of parliamentary seats globally, and are often marginalised within political spheres. Barriers to political participation, including gender stereotypes, discriminatory practices, and limited access to resources, are still prevalent. And violence and harassment, both online and offline, disproportionately targets politicians who identify as women, deterring many women from entering or remaining in politics. Additionally, the gender pay gap persists in political arenas, reflecting broader societal inequalities, which, if you're a working woman, I'm sure you'll be able to relate to. So much work still needs to be done to see more equality in general in the political sphere, and in terms of progress, there could still be much more done. However, the suffragettes did create a path that many women could tread over the subsequent years. The average voter in the UK elections, according to current statistics, identifies as a woman. The greatest proportion of eligible voters in the UK are women, and overall, more women vote than men in elections. Between 1918 and 2024, a total of 564 women have been elected as members of the House of Commons, and as of February 2024, there are 225 women in the House of Commons, which is the highest amount ever, but the split is still not equal, with women only making up 35%. There have only been three female prime ministers. Unfortunately, I'd rather not mention them, but Margaret Thatcher, Theresa May, and Liz Truss. Now for something less Tory. Mary Black, born in 1994, is a Scottish politician who has served as deputy leader of the Scottish National Party, the SNP, in the House of Commons since December 2022. When elected in May 2015, she was 20 years old, making her the youngest MP elected to the House of Commons since the Reform Act of 1832. Mary is openly gay, she's pro-trans rights, and once had a screaming row with a more conservative member of her party over when they opposed Mary's decision to take a drag queen with her to a school to do a storytime event. Of course, Britain's first black female MP, Diane Abbott, has made huge waves within the House of Commons since 1987, where she's stayed ever since in various guises up until her current suspension as of March 2024, when this is being written, which I don't have time to go into here today, but it's safe to say she's still facing institutionalised racism and misogyny, even today. Her speech on the counter-terrorism bill and civil liberties was awarded the Spectator magazine's Parliamentary Speech of the Year award and also received further recognition at the 2008 Human Rights Awards as well. Now, that's just a handful of the high-profile women who have made waves within UK politics, but the fight is not over. Today, we still need to stick up for women working in fields perceived as being male-dominated. If you hear casual misogynistic behaviour at work or experience it yourself, make sure you speak out if you feel comfortable enough to do so, and also report it to managers and HR. If you're a man and you notice the same, do the same for your female colleagues. Usually by asking people to naively explain what they mean, usually makes them think about repeating that behaviour in future. Trust me, it'll be uncomfortable you do it the first time, but then after that, it becomes a sport. In terms of making a difference within politics, if you're in the UK, make sure you're registered to vote and that you also have a photo ID, because now that's unfairly required to be able to vote. Also, make sure your address is up to date on your driver's licence as well, so it's valid, or else it could be refused. Even if you think you're registered, make sure you double check you're still registered, as sometimes they mysteriously kick people off. And if you're uncertain or you don't have photo ID, I will leave some links below so you can find out how you can vote. It's more important than ever in this next election to vote. I won't tell you who you need to vote for, but just make sure you exercise your right. People died for you to do it, so make them proud. From the suffragettes up to the present day, women have faced persistent barriers including underrepresentation in leadership roles, gender-based discrimination, and persistent violence against those that try to change the path of the patriarchal society we live in. So, despite these challenges, women's resilience and determination have driven progress. This direct action, even when it's fallen on the side of being militant, has created significant gains in political participation and rights, not just for women, but for everyone as a whole. Yet an expansive and impossible seeming amount of work remains to be done to achieve true equality. Men, if you're listening, we need your help. We're tired and we've got to start saying women's names in spaces as well as men's. Put us first because we need that support. It's imperative that we acknowledge and address the injustices women continue to face in politics, from the persistent gender pay gap to the pervasive violence and harassment they endure on a daily basis. By standing in solidarity, advocating for change and actively participating in the democratic process, we can work towards a future where women's voices are heard with the same regard as our male counterparts, our rights are upheld, and gender equality is fully realised along with full bodily autonomy. So I implore you, vote. It's the only way they'll hear us, and it's all we've got. Oh my goodness, we've made it. What a series. I still could have made at least another two parts in this. There is so much I have had to leave out. But do please check out my sources if you want to find out more, because it really is just so fascinating. Next time, I'll be back to my old tricks with a good old-fashioned murder. And I can guarantee you won't have heard of this one before, but it's fascinating. So make sure you're subscribed or following to keep up. If you want something a little more lighthearted, then do please check out my Patreon, where you can catch up on my other podcast, which comes out on the opposite week to the regular episodes. Having a Problem is lots of silly historical-based fun, which usually descends into absolute chaos. So if you fancy something a little bit different, then make sure you check it out at patreon.com/macabrelondon or click the link in the description. There's no harm in looking, is there? And I know you're curious, so just give it a go. Make sure you head over to YouTube to take a look at these episodes if you've not yet done so. It really adds faces to names in the story, and you get to see many of the people I talk about, plus me hosting the show as well. And of course, my fabulous outfits. Just search for Macabre London Podcast and I'll pop up. And make sure you say hi. A big thanks to my amazing top-tier legendary executive Patreon producers, Christina, Christoph, Kate, Lisa, Mary, Ravel, Sally, Sam, Sarah, Terry, Teresa, V and Veronica, and all of our other patrons too. If you'd also like your name read out by me at the end of every episode, or your name in the show notes, then signing up to Patreon is the way to make that happen. I hope to see you over there at patreon.com/macabrelondon so I can personally welcome you to the Ghoul Gang. Thanks for joining me for another macabre tale from London's past. I've been Nikki Druce. Remember to stay spooky, and I'll see you ghouls next time.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.